Act 3, Third Strike. Myth is neither a lie nor a confession. It is an inflection. Roland Barthes. 9. A Hole in the Shower. February 2014 through July 2015. The captured kingpin, now more notorious than ever, left Mexico City late in February to await his fate in the country's most forbidding federal prison, the Social Readaptation Center No. 1. Better known as Altiplano for sitting on a high plain 40 miles from the capital, near the city of Toluca, Guzman's new home was a multi-towered fortress, bathed in spotlights and surrounded by razor wire and a vast expanse of crop fields. Not one of the major traffickers who had been jailed there over its 23 years had ever escaped. Altiplano's walls were built of concrete 3 feet thick. Its cells and corridors were monitored by cameras. Its local airspace, a no-fly zone, was heavily restricted. Jamming devices had been put in place to prevent the inmates from communicating with the outside world. Shortly after Guzman was brought to the prison, the administration clamped a bracelet on his wrist, armed with a GPS transmitter. CSEN, the National Intelligence Service, posted 2 employees to its operations center. Given the kingpin's previous escape, they were taking no chances. The spies watched Guzman around the clock on a closed-circuit television set. Even under these austere conditions, Guzman started planning his escape from Altiplano within days of his arrival. To communicate with his conspirators, he worked through 2 accomplices, both with visitation rights. One of them, predictably, was his longtime lawyer, Oscar Gomez, a veteran of his many secret schemes and operations. The other, perhaps more surprisingly, was his young wife, Emma Coronel. Though not yet 25, Emma occupied a unique position in the hierarchy of hundreds that surrounded her husband. While she was not in any formal sense a member of the company, as his organization sometimes called itself, she had long been complicit in a number of his crimes. In 2012, Emma had helped Guzman evade his pursuers in Los Cabos and had often acted as a proxy in his phone calls with her father, Inés Coronel, who had worked with the boss for years running operations on the Arizona border. As the kingpin's wife, Emma enjoyed a privileged primacy in the world of the cartel and clung to it with an aptitude for power that was virtually the equal of his own. Though she may have looked like the former beauty queen she was, her strappy heels and plastic enhancements disguised a mind that was either void of moral sensitivity or was sufficiently conniving to project an air of innocence and ruthlessness at once. If Lucero Sanchez was the kingpin's tool and mistress, Emma was his partner. Her loyalty to Guzman seemed unquestionable, but whether it was based on love, fear, or material comfort was impossible to tell. Footnote: according to the well-worn legend, Emma Coronel Ayispuro, a small-town girl from La Angostura, Durango, first met Chapo Guzman in 2006 after she was crowned the region's local coffee and guava queen. Guzman is said to have attended a dance party following the pageant, arriving with as many as 200 gunmen riding ATVs. A year later, in July 2007, the couple was married. The wedding, Guzman's 3rd or possibly 4th, was a modest affair of accordion music and local politicians in Emma's hometown. The groom wore blue jeans. The bride turned 18. The municipal police were kind enough to close the local roads surrounding the event to uninvited guests. The only excitement came the following day when soldiers from the 9th Military Zone showed up for a raid, hours after the newlyweds had already slipped away. Perhaps it didn't matter. Within a month of her husband being sent to Altiplano, she was already involved in the plot to set him free. The mission planning, at his direction, was divided into 2 parts. Oscar Gomez took charge of assembling a crew of outside experts, a financier to fund the venture, straw men to buy the real estate they needed, and an engineer who devised the means of the prisoner's escape. Emma's job was to enlist a separate circle of collaborators from among the kingpin's relatives and lieutenants. One of the first she spoke to was Damaso López, Guzman's chief of staff. Meeting with Damaso in Culiacán in March 2014, Emma conveyed her husband's orders. The kingpin wanted his top aide to immediately start the process of bribing the guards at Altiplano. It was a task to which Damaso was particularly suited. Long before he had joined the ranks of the company's upper management, Damaso had served as a deputy warden at the Puente Grande prison, in charge of its security, when Guzman was there serving his initial prison term. The two men, almost from the moment of their meeting, saw an opportunity for mutual advantage. Whenever the prisoner needed something, an illegal cell phone or a visit from one of his wives, the deputy warden provided it. Damaso, in exchange, received small gifts of gratitude, boxes of money, or a brand new house in town. Better than anyone, perhaps, Damaso understood the ways in which the staff at Altiplano might be softened and assured the boss's wife that she could count on his assistance. Within a few days, he delegated the task of paying off the guards to one of his own brothers-in-law, presumably with a wad of dirty cash. Once the breakout plot was underway, Guzman had little else to do but wait and return to the details of running the company's business. Most of this business was handled in letters to Damaso, delivered through the spring by the lawyer, Oscar Gomez. It had always been the kingpin's plan for Damaso to take control of the company's operations in his absence, and now he drowned his chief of staff in a flood of endless tasks. In the letters, Damaso was instructed to keep close watch on various policemen, pay the rents for his European front companies, and be certain that the widows of any murdered hitmen received their regular stipends. The crop duster should be started and flown so that it doesn't get ruined, Guzman wrote. Cachimba and Capi Cesar know where it is. In between these petty requests, there was a darker, more disturbing agenda. Alone in his cell at Altiplano, the kingpin, inclined toward paranoia, was searching for the turncoat who had led to his arrest. He soon became obsessed with the idea that his organization was riddled with informants. His suspicions, roving wide, grew to include his local team in Ecuador, his top man in Honduras, even one of his closest friends, Alex Cifuentes. Alex had been sent to Altiplano following his own arrest in late 2013, and a few days after arriving at the prison, Guzman had encountered him in the yard. Their meeting did not go well. Alex's older brother, Jorge, had by then also been arrested and was in American custody, and Guzman walked away from his exchange with Alex, convinced that both men were going to betray him. Not long after seeing Alex, he wrote another letter to Damaso, nervously alerting him to beware of fingers, traitors, and asking him to look after his four sons. There are two things that must be done. No one should know where you all sleep, and don't go to public places. The danger is the people from the company, because they're the ones who know about you, and they're the ones who can set you up. The five of you should talk about what I'm telling you. Like I said, without a finger, they will never find you, and a finger will always be someone close to us. Guzman, in the end, let Alex go with a warning. I told him to keep his mouth shut, he later wrote Damaso. But he was not so liberal with another close aide, who had also lost his trust, Bravo Aponte, his plaza boss in Mazatlan. Aponte, a former soldier who had served the kingpin for a decade, had failed the boss in an irredeemable fashion. After receiving Guzman on the highway from Picudo, his counterpart in Culiacán, Aponte had been charged with protecting Guzman in Mazatlan, where the arrest had taken place. It was often difficult to understand how Guzman decided who would live and who would die, but some combination of Aponte's lapse and his own mounting anxieties pushed him over the edge. In early April, the kingpin reached out to Damaso again, this time instructing him to ask Mayo Zambada to assassinate Aponte. A few days later, the police in Sinaloa found the body. Aponte had been shot 6 times and was dumped beneath a fence outside a factory in La Cruz de Elota, a small town on the western coastline that he had known so well. By late May 2014, the conspirators had finalized their plans. Guzman's sons had now joined the plot, and working in tandem with Oscar Gomez's straw men, they started to look for land near Altiplano, close enough to the prison to be useful, but not so close as to attract unwanted scrutiny. They soon had several options, mostly small ranchitos and derelict industrial spreads that may have once been used by the region's farmers. In his usual role as supervisor, Damaso was asked to be sure there was a structure on whatever property was finally acquired that was large enough to hide the signs of the construction they were planning. It would not have surprised anyone involved that the project's engineer, Lázaro Araújo Burgos, was proposing to build a tunnel. Guzman had been using tunnels since the early 1990s for a variety of purposes, to store his merchandise, to move it under borders, and of course, to accomplish his escapes. Araújo was only the latest tunnel maker in a long line that reached back to Felipe Corona Verbera, who had built the tunnel underneath the pool table near the Arizona border, and José Sánchez Villalobos, whose own projects largely ran from Tijuana to San Diego. But Araújo's job, while similar to those of his predecessors, was constrained by certain technical demands. His central challenge was to get his crew of diggers working underground to cut their way in a more or less straight line directly into the shower of Guzman's cell, the only place that he was not surveilled by Altiplano's cameras. It was likely that Araújo himself came up with a solution to the problem. The breakout team was told to find a watch with a GPS application and to sneak it into the prison past the guards. "We had to buy it and to get it in, to get the coordinates from the cell where my compadre was," Damaso later said. Over the summer, the plotters met to update one another on their progress. Guzman had by that point received the watch. His sons, meanwhile, had closed on a piece of real estate, a cinder block warehouse in a weed-strewn lot in Santa Juanita, a village in the flatlands in sight of Altiplano. When Araújo's tunnel rats moved in, they erected an outbuilding, sleeping on the floors, cooking in the makeshift kitchen, and installing heavy equipment, chiefly an air compressor that would run the tunnel's ventilation system. The compressor was housed in the basement of the warehouse, its exhaust pipes funneled through a gas-powered grill outside in the yard. All told, it was nearly a mile from the tunnel's entrance in the warehouse to its terminus in Guzman's cell, a distance that required as many as a dozen men at least 10 months to quarry. Evidenced by what was left behind, jackhammers, spades, bed litters, oxygen tanks, hydraulic fluid, shoring timbers, steel mesh coils, 45 caliber pistols, and a few unopened beers in the fridge, the work was likely grueling. Little by little, the crew scratched forward, chipping at the soil and stone and slowly hauling out nearly 3,000 tons of earth and debris. To quicken the excavation, the team set up a winch with a heavy-duty cable, and to ensure their own safety, they mounted lengths of PVC pipe on the ceiling to rig the site with fresh air from a blower. Fluorescent bulbs were attached to the pipes to bring in light, and a crude metal track was bolted to the ground. Along the track ran the project's most ingenious innovation, an ersatz rail car powered by the stripped-down frame of a cheap imported motorbike. At a final meeting in mid-2015, Emma brought word to the escape team that her husband wanted to bring things to a head on Saturday, July 4th. "It would be wonderful," he had told her, "to embarrass the Americans on their most important holiday." He had also determined that on summer weekends, the prison was understaffed and there were no official visits from court personnel that might bring extra bodies into the compound. But the tunnel wasn't ready in time, and the plotters decided to delay the operation by a week. By then, Emma was reporting, Guzman could hear the sounds of the construction near his cell. The kingpin's eldest sons did not believe her, but then the two boys, Iván and Alfredo, knew as much about building tunnels as they did about conducting secret missions. A few months earlier, even as the digging crew was still underground, Iván had gone onto Twitter and boasted to the world, "I promise you the general will be back soon." It was a reckless breach of security, one that he made worse just days before the planned escape, when he posted another tweet, "Everything comes for those who know how to wait." After waiting for a year and a half, the solitary inmate in cell 20, in corridor 2 of the Altiplano prison, appeared in normal spirits. It was the evening of July 11th, 2015, and to anyone observing him, as certainly they were, it would have seemed like any other Saturday night in summer. The prisoner, in his jailhouse pajamas, was stretched out full beneath the covers of his bunk. He was watching TV from a tablet on the nightstand, cradling a pillow at his head. The show that he had on, presumably a comedy of some sort, was full of raucous laughter and applause. But even with the volume turned up high, it was not enough to muffle the racket of what seemed to be a hammer pounding under the floor beneath his shower stall. Looking mildly curious, like a man who had heard a dog bark in the night, he pushed back his blanket and got out of bed to investigate the sound. For the next few minutes, he was on his feet, walking back and forth in a manner that was, as an official report would later note, the natural behavior of inmates. After further pacing and a quick stop on the bed to change his shoes, he rose again and returned to the shower. This time, he crouched down behind its low half wall. As the laughter cackled from the tablet on his nightstand, Guzman dropped into the small hole that had been cut in the shower floor. And with that maneuver, he was gone. 26 minutes later, at 9:18 p.m., a guard showed up outside his empty cell. "Guzman," he called. "Guzman. Guzman Loera. Can you hear me?" When no one responded, the guard reached for his radio and alerted his commander. "Comandante, can you hear me?"
"What happened?"
"There is a hole in the shower."
"What?"
"There is a hole in the shower."
"There is a hole?"
Confirmed. In the drain of the shower, there is a hole."
"What size is it?"
"Very big, comandante. Big."
"But is the inmate there?"
"No, comandante. He is not." After ducking through the hole, Guzman had clambered down a 30-foot ladder. At the bottom of the ladder, he was met by Emma's brother, Edgar Coronel. Edgar ferried him to safety, taking the controls of the motorcycle rail car as Guzman rode in front of him on the platform. Rushing forward through the bulb-lit darkness, they made their way toward the tunnel's exit in the warehouse. There, the kingpin slipped out of his prison clothes, grabbed a weapon, and hopped aboard a waiting ATV. After that, there was a brief ride to a second warehouse, where the fugitive was hidden in the trailer of a truck for the two-hour drive on local roads to San Juan del Río, Querétaro. On the outskirts of the city was a fumigation airstrip, and on the airstrip were two small planes, fueled and ready for takeoff. One of the planes was a decoy meant to distract pursuers, but the other, manned by Cachimba, the kingpin's favorite pilot, sailed into the night. 40 minutes later, the red alert went out at Altiplano. But by that point, Guzman was already en route to his home in the Sierras and a mountaintop encampment called the Sky. 10. The High Side. July 2015 through January 2016. Donovan's wife woke him in the morning with the news. Half asleep, he dismissed it as a joke.
"Get up," her words came through to him as a hand pushed at his shoulder. "Ray, get up. Chapo just escaped."
"Sure," he thought. "Escaped. You're hilarious." But the hand kept pushing until he heard a sound that might have been the sound of his phone going crazy on the nightstand. Rolling over, he saw that there were panicked texts
from Washington, Virginia, Mexico City. The TV, when it turned on, was worse. There it was on cable, every anchor in America discussing the destruction of his life's achievement. Sick to his stomach, Donovan hadn't even had his morning cup of coffee yet. It was total turmoil, he recalled. The biggest thing in my career, and now it's a complete disaster. Footnote, Bob Potash had a similar experience. He was on vacation with his wife down south, a work moratorium in effect, when his phone started buzzing at 6 a.m. It was a colleague from New York texting to say that Guzman had escaped. When his wife asked what was going on, Potash told her. At first, she did not believe him. It took Googling Chapo and escape to persuade her. The rest of the day was in ruins. Back in the office that first day, Donovan monitored developments on the ground. The Mexicans were going crazy, mobilizing anyone in a uniform, down to the Boy Scouts, it appeared. Hundreds of federal highway cops had set up checkpoints near the prison and on all roads leading from Toluca into neighboring states. More police had taken over toll booths and set up posts in 3 different airports in the region. The Army had surrounded Altiplano, and the Navy had sent its own troops to the area from more than 12 bases. Marine commandos on both coasts of the country had been placed on high alert. Promoted after his accomplishments in Mazatlan, Donovan was now in charge of SOD's entire Mexican section, which meant that it was his responsibility to figure out what the hell had happened down there. Admittedly, even with Guzman's prior history, he hadn't given too much thought to the chance of another escape. Once, he figured, maybe, but twice, and from the country's most secure federal prison? The general consensus in Chantilly had always been that Guzman would eventually stand trial in the United States. His extradition would no doubt be delayed by the usual legal wrangling, but everyone at SOD believed that in another few years, the kingpin would be flown up to New York or Chicago, and it would be done for good. Donovan had not lost sight completely of the happenings in Mexico. He had kept loose tabs on the politics and the lawyerly maneuvers. But along the way, he soon discovered he had missed something. As part of his new job, he had recently pitched in on a field office wiretap in Tucson that was surveilling some of Mayo Zambada's men. Among the messages the wire had intercepted were a few obscure mentions of a warehouse that one of Guzman's own crews had been building. When Donovan went back to check the line sheets, it was obvious, in hindsight, that the targets of the wire had been talking about the warehouse outside Altiplano. Though he and his colleagues had no way of knowing it at the time, Sinaloa had planned the escape directly under their eyes. Slumped behind his desk at SOD, Donovan realized he had a choice to make. He could either accept defeat and let the Mexicans fix the mess, or he could suck up yet another failure, and hard to believe that he was thinking this, do it all again. Whether it was the burdens of promotion, or a kind of self-inflicted castigation, or simply an obsession with the man who had slipped his grasp, he decided by the end of the week to put the coalition back together. At that point, there was only one question. Who was going to join in the pursuit this second time? Drew Hogan, in a blaze of burned bridges, had already left the DEA's embassy office to start work on a book. Victor Vasquez had gone off as well to a new assignment in Arizona, but Brian Maxwell was still in Mexico and the narco polo team was still in San Diego. Donovan, knowing they were fellow Guzman zealots, was able to recruit them to his team. After the kingpin's last arrest in February 2014, Jake Healy, from Homeland Security Investigations, had left Nogales for Washington, D.C. There had been threats that Guzman's sons were coming after him and other law enforcement agents working on the border. Though Healy's wiretap had largely been dismantled, he had been working with the Justice Department, which had finally indicted several of his targets, among them Speedy, Omega, and Rincon, the kingpin's operative in Ecuador. When Healy got Donovan's offer to work at SOD and finish what they started, he accepted. He brought along Nick Nordstrom, one of his partners from Nogales. As the team came together, Donovan was still in need of an intelligence machine to replace the shutdown wire in Nogales. For that, he turned to two new faces, both of them from New York. Fernando Cruz, a hulking man with the unlikely nickname Fern, was one of the DEA's top data nerds, a technical savant with a gift for crunching numbers to crack communication systems. Based on Long Island, Cruz had for years been chasing Mayo Zambada, most recently with Michael Robati, a tall, lanky prosecutor working out of Brooklyn. Now that Guzman was at large again, Donovan sought to reorient their talents.
"We needed records and data," he said, "because without the intel, we were dead in the water."
Michael was the most aggressive prosecutor in the country, a monster in the most respectful way, and Fern was the perfect match, relentless and totally committed. With the Second Coalition now in place, all that Donovan needed was a codename for his mission. After the swing and miss in Cabo and the vexing foul tip of the escape, this attempt, he hoped, would be the final pitch at Guzman. He called the operation Third Strike. Before it began in earnest that summer, Donovan added one more weapon to his arsenal. It was a secret weapon, discussed in whispers, even inside SOD, the National Security Agency. Since its founding in 1952, the NSA had been the country's foremost collector of signals or communications intelligence. Based at an Army base in Fort Meade, Maryland, 40 minutes from Washington, D.C., it was even more clandestine than the CIA. Its initials, people joked, stood for No Such Agency. In July 2015, as Operation Third Strike was getting underway, the NSA was still recovering from the scandal that had broken out 2 years earlier when Edward Snowden, a former contractor, leaked thousands of secret documents suggesting that its spies had engaged in a pattern of illegal surveillance on American citizens. Donovan had approached the agency cautiously at first, but after several meetings, some of them over crab cakes at a local Maryland seafood joint, he came to admire the spooks and analysts who worked within its walls. With its traditional ties to the intelligence community, SOD had been working on the Guzman case with the spies at NSA, in one form or another, since at least 2012, tracking the kingpin's movements and occasionally snooping on his chats and conversations through warrantless surveillance from what was known in law enforcement circles as the high side. Even during the heyday of the wiretap machine, Donovan had availed himself of the agency's secret listening techniques. At that point, the NSA's efforts had been somewhat less essential. The low side, or court-approved intercepts that Donovan was getting from Nogales, San Diego, Chicago, and New York, were already so numerous and rich with information that he didn't need much off-the-books assistance. Throughout 2013, as the coalition mapped the kingpin's network and cracked the office system, the NSA had been helpful, mostly, as a backstop, monitoring Guzman and his allies when and in ways the low-side listeners could not. After Duck Dynasty, when things got operational and sped up on the ground, the spooks became more central in the chase. The thing was, Fort Meade's spies were fast. If the coalition needed something on the fly, the NSA could get it. But what the high side had in speed, it lacked in understanding. Its analysts were nowhere near as skilled at deciphering the office's coded chats as the wiretap readers in Nogales, who had all spent months immersed in the cartel's BBM texts and had developed an instinctive feeling for the diction and the habits of their targets. Under Donovan's guidance, the spies and agents in the first operation had worked on separate but symbiotic tracks. Staying in their own lanes, they harmonized the gathering of evidence that could be used to prove their case against the kingpin with a collection of intelligence that could lead to his arrest. Ray embraced the idea that different people could help at different times, one member of the coalition said. It was like a baseball team. One guy is good at hitting curves, another guy is good at hitting fastballs. It's good to have both guys in the lineup side by side. By the time Third Strike was launched, Donovan had placed the high-side hitters at the heart of his new lineup. This was a decision matching tactical abilities with circumstantial realities. With Guzman on the run again, speed was of the essence. There was also no real need this time to collect more evidence. The Arizona wiretap alone had vacuumed up more than 1 million intercepts, sufficient proof to convict the kingpin and dozens of his allies 10 times over. In Third Strike's sleeker world, a new working paradigm emerged. Donovan and his team at SOD, digging, 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 as he put it, collected BlackBerry pins from anywhere they could find them. The remnants of Drew Hogan's work, the Mexican authorities investigating Guzman's escape, confidential informants, and dormant lines from Nogales. Once they had those BlackBerry pins, Fernando Cruz would send them on to Brooklyn, where Mike Robati, the prosecutorial monster, worked around the clock to get judicial permission to examine their call records. The records were then sent back to Cruz, who leaned into the data and determined which devices were the hottest, or seemed like nodes, on the network. Some of the hot phones were forwarded to Fort Meade for secret interception. Summaries of the intercepts were often returned to SOD, where Healy and Nordstrom, skilled wire readers, struggled to interpret and make sense of them. This new machine, designed to hunt, was infinitely quicker than the old one, and within a matter of weeks, the coalition had hacked back into the pyramid of mirrors. Donovan and his team hadn't spied on Guzman in more than a year, but eavesdropping on the kingpin and his entourage was not unlike tuning in to the second season of a good TV show. All the familiar players had returned. There was Damaso Lopez, holding things together as he always did, and there was Cachimba, the kingpin's favorite pilot. Emma Coronel, Guzman's wife, was still in the picture, and so was much of the rambling support cast of doctors, lawyers, accountants, cooks, and finance guys. As with any good TV show, there were a few new characters too, or rather, those who had stepped from the background of the story into more important roles. Cholo Ivan, the impulsive killer from Los Mochis, was back this season playing what appeared to be a larger part as Guzman's top security chief. In an unexpected twist, Lucero Sanchez, the kingpin's mistress, had run for public office and was now serving as an elected representative in the Sinaloa Congress. Many of the intercepts suggested that Guzman himself had once again holed up in his stronghold in the mountains in between his home state and its neighboring state, Durango. That meant that his brother Aureliano, who was based nearby, had also become more prominent this time and was roaming the countryside, protecting Guzman with scores of local gunmen. After getting the early readouts, Donovan noticed something, though. It seemed Fort Meade was picking up a steady stream of messages flowing up the pyramid from all the usual places. Guzman's sons, his girlfriends, the aides who brought his food, but wasn't seeing answers coming back down in the opposite direction. The top tier of the pyramid, Guzman's tier, that is, appeared to be hidden in a void. Donovan could see the void, the contours of its emptiness, and they were troubling. The void suggested something ominous had happened. The kingpin had traded in his old devices for fully encrypted black phones. It had to be the tech team, Donovan thought, or even worse, Chaneke. The tech team was bad enough when Christian Rodriguez fled his job with Guzman in late 2012. Other techies like Charlie Martinez had taken his place. Building on the young Colombian's work, Martinez could easily have made possible the sudden switch to black phones, which would have pleased Chaneke, the kingpin's latest bodyguard, who had taken over after Condor was arrested at the Miramar. A counter-surveillance expert, Chaneke was exceptionally cagey, changing his own phones constantly and avoiding signature monikers like Condor's helicopter models. It would have been exactly like Chaneke to have requisitioned new phones that even the spooks at the NSA were having trouble cracking. The coalition hated Chaneke. Chaneke was smart, and he didn't make mistakes. Wherever Guzman was, in a hilltop hut, an encampment in the forest, or hiding in a cave in a narrow mountain valley, If he was with Chaneke, finding him was going to be a chore. In Mexico, however, Ryan Maxwell had just found Chaneke. The bodyguard and his boss, B-Max had discovered, had garrisoned themselves with a company of gunmen at a small ranch in the dense jungle wilderness 20 miles outside Cosalá, Lucero Sanchez's hometown. From the start of Operation Third Strike, Maxwell had been in the field again, traveling with the Mexican Marines. But the Marines in 2015 were not the same Marines they had been the year before. In the months since Guzman's last arrest, the professional commando unit, which had always been skilled in tactical maneuvers, had greatly enhanced its intelligence capacity. Much like SOD had struck up a relationship with the spies at the NSA, the Marines had forged a partnership with their own country's spies at the intelligence service, CSEN. The inner workings of any secret agency can be nebulous at best, but every now and then, the coalition heard things. Recently, they had picked up whispers about a covert wiretap that CSEN had been running from its own perch on the high side. The managers of the CSEN wire, or so the whispers said, had focused their attention on certain Mexican political officials suspected of helping Guzman in the weeks and months that preceded his escape. One of the wire's targets was the newly elected politician Lucero Sanchez. Some of Guzman's lawyers and his trusted pilot Cachimba had been targeted as well. Imagine then the embarrassment CSEN must have felt when Guzman managed to escape in spite of this surveillance. The disconnected threads of the plot were right there and its wiretap recordings, ready to be tied together and prevented if anyone had noticed them in time. The situation, while undeniably awkward, at least had an upside. If the spies at CSEN now resolved to go after Guzman quickly, all they had to do was pass the information they had gleaned from their wire to their new collaborators, the Mexican Marines, who were already working with Maxwell's snatch-and-grab team. It would not be easy to find the kingpin in all that highland jungle, but with a basic location provided by the wire, the village of Cosalá, and the right equipment, a cell site simulator flown in an airplane at the proper height and speed, it was only a matter of time. Donovan was impressed. He had noticed from the outset of Third Strike that the Mexicans were on their game in this iteration of the chase in a way that they had never been before. Every time the coalition developed a new lead, his counterparts in Mexico already seemed to be onto it. Eventually, he learned how they had managed the trick. Aside from its wiretap, CSEN had a second secret weapon, a classified Israeli technology called Pegasus. Pegasus, created by the NSO Group, a tech firm based near Tel Aviv, accomplished what appeared to be an impossible task. It broke into even the most encrypted phones remotely, and milliseconds before the data housed in them was encoded, stole it without leaving a trace. Nothing was safe from the system's prying fingers. Phone calls, texts, emails, even chats on Facebook, Skype, and WhatsApp could be pilfered. Though the software was devilishly intricate, the way it penetrated phones was relatively simple. NSO would send its targets innocent-looking texts or emails known as Trojan horses, and as soon as the messages were opened, the malware was installed. Pegasus was expensive. NSO charged its clients each time it was used. But by spending cautiously, the operatives at CSEN were able to map out Guzman's black phone network one phone at a time. In late September, armed with CSEN's intelligence, the Marines went into training, preparing to raid the ranch outside Cosalá. There was every indication it was going to take a fight. The mountain property was little more than a smattering of huts, but Guzman and his soldiers had fortified themselves beneath the lush woodland cover. As the day of the assault, October 2nd, neared, Donovan was filled with anxious pride. It was a huge accomplishment that only weeks after Third Strike had begun, the Marines were getting ready to attack. He and the coalition were getting ready too. In preparation for the raid on Cosalá, they arranged to put a drone in the air above the ranch with a live feed piped into Chantilly. The team at SOD would get to watch. The day before the raid went off, Donovan got an email. Sitting at his desk in Virginia, he saw it had come from a colleague at Customs who was writing to alert him that one of the subjects of his Chapo Guzman case was about to leave an airport in Van Nuys, California, on a private jet for Mexico. The subject in question, the Mexican actress Kate del Castillo, was, according to the flight report, traveling with three other passengers. Scrolling through the email, Donovan clocked two of the passengers as Argentinian film producers. The third, however, was an American. And a disaster, it was the actor Sean Penn. Donovan was familiar, all too familiar by then, with the strange events that had placed the star in the middle of his capture operation. Earlier that winter, while Guzman was still in prison, he had asked his lawyers, including Oscar Gomez, who was planning his escape, to contact Del Castillo with yet another play to make his movie, and she had finally relented. The project, at that stage, had been in turnaround for nearly a year. Everyone associated with it was either in custody, as Guzman was himself, or was running from the kingpin for their lives. Apparently unaware that her new business partner had tried to kill both his writer, Javier Rey, and Andrea Vélez, the assistant he had assigned to the project, Del Castillo reached an agreement with the kingpin to buy his life rights with the two Argentinians, Fernando Sulichin and José Ibáñez. After Guzman escaped from Altiplano and was front-page news for days, Sean Penn joined the team. While Del Castillo was convinced that the involvement of a Hollywood celebrity would make the film more viable, Penn was noncommittal. He was, however, interested in meeting Guzman, having made his own arrangements to interview the kingpin for Rolling Stone magazine. Third Strike intersected with his three-ring circus not long after the operation started. Near the end of September 2015, 2 months after Guzman's escape, Del Castillo flew to Guadalajara, ostensibly for the birthday party of a friend, but also to meet with Guzman's lawyers. The coalition had been spying on the lawyers for weeks and intercepted the actress chatting through them with their boss. Using the same filter-based communication system he had devised to make his drug deals, the kingpin asked the actress to join him at a ranch near Mazatlan to discuss their pending deal. Del Castillo, sounding starstruck, accepted the invitation. 9:55 p.m. Amiga, I really want to meet you and become good friends. You are the best of this world. I will take care of you more than I do my own eyes. 10:11 p.m. It moves me so much that you say you'll take care of me. Nobody has ever taken care of me, thank you. And I'll be free next weekend. Once they set a date, October 2nd, Del Castillo went back to her party. The lawyers stayed on the line, and Guzman ordered them to buy the actress a BlackBerry so that they could chat in private, a pink one if they could find it. When the lawyers told the boss that Del Castillo was planning to bring not only the Argentinians, but Sean Penn too, one of the most recognized actors in Hollywood, Guzman admitted he had never heard of Penn. Searching his filmography on Google, one of the lawyers reported that Penn was the star of 21 Grams and had directed The Pledge and The Crossing Guard, both of which, he pointed out, had featured Jack Nicholson. Within a few hours, Guzman himself had looked up Penn on Google. He was sold. All of this was so insane that even now, with the Marines in place outside Cosala, Donovan had no idea what to make of it. He was not alone in his bafflement. Other members of the coalition had taken their reports on the Del Castillo intercepts into the so-called SCIF at SOD, a secure facility for classified material, and come out looking mystified and ashen. The absurdity was overwhelming, veering off in a dozen different directions. It was undeniably mental that the NSA, the NSA, had used its secret hardware to eavesdrop on the world's most wanted criminal vetting Sean Penn's Hollywood career. And yet, it was in keeping with Guzman's schizophrenic world. after being privy for nearly 3 years to the most intimate aspects of the Kingpin's life. Donovan wasn't surprised. "It all goes back to how his mind works," he said. Kate was in touch with him when he was still in prison, but now that he was out, he was a big man again. He's always been the same, arrogant, cocky, narcissistic. He wanted to be bigger than Escobar. He wanted to tell his story. Seconds after reading the email from Customs, Donovan was on the phone to the embassy in Mexico. Working up the chain of command, he finally got the DEA's regional director on the line. "Look," he said, "Sean Penn's going to be there. I don't know if we can launch." Donovan wasn't sure if they should still do the op. He wasn't sure if they could still do the op. Maybe, he said, they should scrub it or delay it. The regional director promised to get back to him after speaking with the Mexicans. The real issue, Donovan understood, was not Sean Penn. The real issue was that SOD was certain, given what it knew about Guzman, that he would never bring his visitors to the place where he was hiding. Instead, it was assumed, he would leave the property near Cosalá and meet them somewhere else. And that, to put it lightly, would be challenging since the strike team of Marines had already spent days practicing maneuvers designed to hit that ranch. When the embassy got back to him, Donovan was stunned to hear that the Marines still wanted to go forward. After all their training, he was told, their attitude appeared to be, "Fuck Sean Penn. The raid goes on as planned." At that point, there wasn't much that he or any other American could do. The Mexicans were in charge of operations on the ground and had been tracking Penn and Del Castillo from the moment that their jet touched down at the Guadalajara airport. Under surveillance, the actors and their Argentinian partners had gone to their hotel, dropped off their belongings, and then, escorted by the Kingpin's men, were driven to a nearby airstrip where they boarded a pair of Cessnas. That's when things had threatened to go off the rails. As they all took off, the Marines had abruptly improvised a new plan. They wanted to follow the actors to Guzman's mountain compound and send in the Blackhawks underneath the cover of their planes. Squelching that idea led to an uproarious, international shouting match, which nearly rose to the level of a diplomatic incident. It was complete and total panic, a living shit show, one member of the coalition said. No one, nobody, knew what to do. In the end, the Kingpin and the weather took control of the situation. Guzman, as expected, left his ranch outside Cosalá and met the stars in a much less compromising setting, a darkly wooded patch of the University of Sinaloa's ecology reserve. But even if he had stayed put, the raid would still have been impossible. Late that night, a storm blew through the mountains with sheets of monsoon rain and great bolts of lightning like flashbang grenades, as Penn would later write. The strike team's Blackhawks never left the ground. 4 days later, when the skies were clear and the visitors were gone, the Marines tried again. It was now October 6th, and daybreak in Cosalá. At SOD headquarters, Donovan and his team gathered around a monitor. The drone was in the air this time, and they watched the operation through its feed. Their pixelated live screen showed the muddle of the skirmish. First, the helicopters wheeling toward the little mountain clearing, and then the bursts of phosphorescent gunfire streaking toward the sky. As the Black Hawks hovered, some of the Kingpin's men began to scatter, and after that, it was chaos. Donovan could see the hazy shapes of ATVs racing through the compound and the splotches of the strike team descending their rappelling lines. But at a distance, in the disarray of vehicles and bodies, it was hard to tell what was happening on the ground. Guzman, he was later told, had holed up during the worst of the fighting with his cooks and one of their children, protected by a handful of his gunmen. Then, as the Marines fanned out, kicking down doors and taking over buildings, he had ducked into the bush and slipped away. 10 days later, he was still on the run. On each of those excruciating mornings, when Donovan got to work, there might, if he was lucky, be an update. Kept in the loop by Maxwell in the field and by a liaison at the embassy in Mexico, he knew that after losing sight of Guzman The Marines had tried to pen him in by encircling Koh Sala. They had dropped a ring of roadblocks on the mountain byways in an iron net from Tamasula to Verano. Scouring the countryside on foot and in the air, they were stopping pickup trucks, breaking into houses, and rounding up farmers believed to have been sheltering the kingpin. But as the search went on from house to house and from town to town, the troops were getting nowhere, and hundreds of local residents, displaced by the violence, were starting to get angry. Some of the refugees had gone to the media, complaining about their frightened children and their bullet-ridden windows. "They shot our homes," they said. "They torched our cars." The Marines, it was true, could be brutal. But the coalition also suspected that Lucero Sanchez, the district's representative, was quietly behind the publicity campaign. From a tactical perspective, the Koh Sala mission was becoming unsustainable. Inside the villages, the residents were terrified. Outside the villages, the rocky brush and deep pine forest were impenetrable. Moving in between the villages, the Marines were exposed to constant attacks from Guzman's brother Aureliano and another local warlord known as Memo. Some of these attacks, Donovan heard in exhausted calls with Maxwell, were even more ferocious than the first one in Koh Sala. They were full-scale battles with men on four-wheel buggies firing machine guns and shoulder-mounted rockets. Donovan needed a break. But stuck at SOD, there was little he could do. Maxwell was calling several times a day with BlackBerry pins seized from prisoners they had taken. Working with Mike Robati, Fernando Cruz secured their call logs and squeezed the pins for information, looking for a pattern, a digital map that could point them toward the phones that Guzman and Chaneke might be using. But as the data came back, there didn't seem to be a pattern or much of a map. Before the raid in Koh Sala, they had at least seen the void at the top tier of the pyramid. Now it all seemed like a void. The break came just as a deep mood of gloom threatened to consume SOD. Maxwell called one day to report that the Marines had captured a crew of Guzman's lookouts. The lookouts had been using simple radios, but when Maxwell and his team listened to the radios, they heard transmissions describing what appeared to be a new communication system, encrypted walkie-talkies. These walkie-talkies weren't just standard portable devices. They seemed to be connected to a large, private Wi-Fi network boosted through the mountains by a series of repeaters. Maxwell recognized the method. Guzman's enemies, the Zetas, had used something similar for a decade. When he tracked the signal and hacked into the walkie-talkie network, he discovered good news. According to the chatter, Guzman had fallen in Koh Sala and broken one of his legs. With the boss severely hobbled, Chaneke and Cholo Ivan, his new security chief, had been hauling him through the wilderness on anything they could find. Donkeys, rafts, and all-terrain vehicles. Donovan allowed himself a glimmer of excitement. How far could Guzman get? Could anybody get with a broken leg on donkey back? Another day, however, brought more chatter on the walkie-talkies. The two lieutenants and their injured boss had managed to slip the military cordon. They were gone. No one could believe it. But there it was, not only in the encrypted walkie-talkie runs, but in corroborating intercepts from Pegasus. Soon, the Mexicans had more bad news to report. After ducking the Marine perimeter, Guzman and Chaneke had made their way back to the kingpin's birthplace in La Tuna. 300 miles to the north, La Tuna sat in a swath of the Sierras that was arguably more remote and treacherous than Koh Sala. Filled with farmers and ranchers he had known his entire life, it was also more familiar and friendlier terrain. Not long after arriving in La Tuna, Guzman, it appeared, had settled in at one of his ranches, surrounded by an army captained by his brother, who was based in the region's municipal seat in Badiraguato. He was comfortable enough up there that he reached out again to Kate del Castillo. 10:15 p.m. "Amiga, we must see each other. Everything will be calm. If I wasn't sure, I wouldn't invite you. I want you to interview the men and women of my ranch. My mom wants to meet you. I told her about you.
If the Mexican assessments were correct, Guzman had gone native in La Duna. By late October, the intercepts from Pegasus were suggesting something straight out of Osama bin Laden's playbook. The kingpin and Chaneke had, it seemed, started to split their time between the ranch in La Duna and a kind of mountain cave miles from the nearest human settlement. There wasn't much of an appetite to head into the wilderness and get them. If going into Culiacan had been like going into the lion's den, trekking into the woods around La Duna would be like walking naked into the savannah. But there was a different option. Recently, the spies at CSEN and the NSA had been picking up indications that Guzman was building a house in Los Mochis, a sweaty little beach town a few hours north of Culiacan. Donovan was intrigued by the project. Los Mochis was the stronghold of Cholo Ivan, the kingpin's chief of security. Two more of Guzman's top men seemed to be in charge of the construction of the house. One of them was an engineer nicknamed La Quinta, who had designed several tunnels for the kingpin and had managed the development of his refuge at Duck Dynasty. The other was Charlie Martinez, Christian Rodriguez's protege on the tech team. With talent like that involved, the house had to be more than just a house. It had to be a safe house. And there was only one reason why Guzman would be building another safe house now. He wanted to leave La Duna for Los Mochis. The high side now turned its attention to La Quinta and Martinez. Once both CSEN and the NSA homed in on them, finding the house was relatively easy. By mid-November 2015, an undercover unit of Marines was quietly posted at the white two-story structure, which sat in the heart of Las Palmas, one of Los Mochis' wealthiest residential neighborhoods. From the outside, it seemed normal, sitting on a peaceful street of parked cars and power lines a few blocks from a Walmart. There was a gated garage and a large olive tree obscuring its facade. The hard part was waiting for the kingpin to arrive. Days, then weeks, went by, and there was still no sign of movement in Los Mochis, nor was there much to report from the mountains. With Chaneke at his side, Guzman had apparently gone silent. In early December, losing patience, the Marines decided to offer him encouragement. Dozens of troops, supported in the air by helicopter gunships, were sent up Highway 24 and started laying siege to La Duna and the villages around it in an operation even more aggressive than the one that had been launched outside Cosala. Roads were blocked, entire towns were overrun. Guzman's brother's ranch was occupied and seized. The Sinaloans did not submit quietly to this. Bloody gunfights erupted in the streets, and at least 8 people were killed. But this was part of the strategy, to hit the kingpin hard in his home where it would hurt. The Marines were sticking to their game plan. If he was going to hide up there living on tortillas, they were going to make damn sure he didn't get the luxury of beans. Finally, near Christmas, there was chatter on the wire. Orders from the boss to his underlings in Culiacan. He wanted them to pick up 3 bouquets of flowers and 3 new sets of sheets. After all of it, was he really that predictable? It seemed he was. With the holidays approaching, it appeared he was coming down to see his wives and girlfriends. But how, the Marine commanders wondered, should they handle this new twist? Culiacan was a far better target than the mountains were, but it was nowhere near as good a target as Los Mochis. It had to be possible to get him out of one and into the other. A different plan, then. Do nothing. It was the holidays, after all, and much of Mexico had already shut down. If the Marines shut down as well, pulled the troops from La Duna, sent the undercovers in Los Mochis home, perhaps the kingpin would catch wind of it and decide to make a move. And doing nothing was risky, and it relied on Guzman still being tapped into the flow of rumor and military chit-chat that moved through Mexico City. But once the Marines resolved to try it, they quietly spread the word. The operation was going on a holiday hiatus.
Christmas in Mexico is generally celebrated from the Feast of the Virgin of Guadalupe to Three Kings Day, a period lasting from December 12th to January 6th. On January 7th, one day after the season ended, Pegasus caught an interesting message. "Nana is coming," it said. The undercovers, back in place, saw him arrive in Los Mochis. A truck dropped him off within the city limits, and a white van picked him up. Then the watchers, close behind the van, followed him to the White House in Las Palmas. If they weren't sure at first that it was him, they were soon after. As midnight neared, one of his men hopped into the van and went to fetch supplies for the night, corn and an order of tacos. The raid was set for early the following morning, January 8th, 2016. There was no drone feed this time. Donovan got the details after it went down. He was informed, as a preliminary matter, that 17 Marines hit the safe house door at about 4:30 as dozens of support troops stayed outside to monitor the manhole covers up and down the block. He was also told that when the men on point stormed into the vestibule, they encountered what appeared to be a maze of walls and doorways. That was when they started taking fire. Later, he got the photographs, bodies slumped in corners or bleeding on the floor. The Marines advanced into the gunfire with hand grenades and rifles, sweeping through the house from room to room. They started in the kitchen, where junk food wrappers were strewn across the table, and moved toward the final bedroom, where a flat-screen TV set was playing on the wall. By the time they left, five of Guzman's men lay dead, among them his bodyguard Chaneke. But the kingpin himself was nowhere to be found. He had already fled with Cholo Ivan through La Quinta's latest invention. Not the decoy tunnel underneath the fridge, the real one, hidden behind a mirror in the master bedroom closet. Within hours, even the smallest regional papers had the rest of it. Emerging from a manhole cover near the Walmart, Guzman and Cholo Ivan stole a Volkswagen. When the Volkswagen stalled a few blocks later, they commandeered another car, a red Ford Focus, and took off south, headed out of town. Some of the details varied here and there. They had escaped with pistols or maybe an assault rifle. Cholo Ivan did, or perhaps did not, politely return a purse to the woman driving the Ford. It was, however, widely reported that when the federal police stopped their car at a checkpoint on the southbound lane of Highway 15, the officers who pulled them over were terrified. They had heard on their radios that an army of gunmen was already en route to rescue Guzman. Hurrying their prisoners off the street, they took them blocks away to a quiet room in an hourly motel. There, the police showed remarkable restraint in resisting every lever Guzman tried to use on them, ignoring his death threats and turning down his offer of $1 million. Picking up a phone, they coolly placed a call to the Marines, then waited like heroes for the cavalry to arrive. And that was the end of it. Except for one thing, it was not at all what the coalition heard. In the different story that had come to them from Mexico, no one had called the Marines to tell them that the kingpin had been captured. Instead, while chasing Guzman somewhere near the city of Guasave, they drove by chance past a tow truck with a red Ford Focus on its lift. The Marines immediately recognized the vehicle as the one that had been stolen, and after some persuasion, the tow truck driver confessed where he had gotten the car, from someplace called the Hotel Du, on the outskirts of Los Mochis. When the Marines raced over, they found two police officers hiding in the parking lot out back beside their squad car. In the car were Chapo Guzman and Cholo Ivan Castellum, their hands uncuffed and apparently hiding too. Were the men in the custody of the two courageous officers, or were the officers in league with them? And why had they been taken to an hourly motel and not to jail? Well, the coalition had its opinions, but those were questions better left to the Mexican authorities to answer on their own.